All right. It's a pleasure to kick off what should be a wonderful weekend of learning. And over Shabbos and, of course, all day Sunday, and Rabbi Liebtag, who I think needs no introduction, but is really one of the premier teachers of Tanakh, founder of the Tanakh Study Center in Har Etzion. And, of course, he teaches in the Kush and then lots of places in Israel and in lots of places in Chutz Lars too. And he'll actually be in Hamilton over Shabbos, where his family comes from. The origins of the Liebtag, you know, your family part of it is Hamilton. So it's interesting. It's a little bit of a homecoming. So it's always a pleasure to have him. Vakasha. Okay, Rabbi Liebtag, I'm Megillat Esther, identifying the author and the audience, I believe.
Who's the author?
Who's the audience?
Yeah, okay. I'm assuming that everyone knows the first line of the Megillah. Are there Megillot, Jay? Okay, so we don't need them yet. We'll get them in a second. Okay, I'm sure everyone remembers the first line of the Megillah. Remember, Vayivi Me'ach Hashverosh, and what follows? It follows who this Hashverosh was. Which one? Hamolech Mihodu Ad Kush. Now, if I have only that opening line, what can I assume about the time period of when the book is being written? Is it written at that time period or a later time period? It has to be later. If you're writing something happening in real time, you say, you can just say Achashverosh. But if you have to say which Achashverosh it was, and it seems like it's written at least a little bit later. That would be for sure. Now, according to Chazal, who did they attribute Megillat Esther to? In Baba Batra, Daf Yudalad, they talk about all the different books. Who the author? Anyone who knows who they attribute the authorship to? Okay. In Yeshiva world, some people say, no, Esther. It can't be a female. She writes a letter, but was that Megillat Esther? From what you remember, who wrote the Megillah? Yeah. Yeah. Who learned that Mordechai wrote the Megillah? Yeah. So why would Mordechai write about when the king was the old king? No. There's a pasuk in the Megillah that people sort of relate to the Megillah, which isn't the Megillah, but we'll get there very soon. But according to Chazal, the book was written by Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, which are the men of the Great Assembly. Now, it could be that Mordechai was one of those members, but the book is being written in the land of Israel. And that's a big question. When you're reading a book, the question isn't just a technical one, who's the author and who's the audience, but it affects how you read the book. Because when I'm reading a book, I always have to ask myself, who is the book being written for? I'll give a really bad example. We'll start this share in about 3-4 minutes because there's always an arrival curve and it's bad weather. So we'll give a little time for people to, because once we get started, we have to follow from the beginning. But anytime you study a book, you always have to take into consideration, for what purpose is the book being written? Who's the audience? And who's the author? Especially a book of prophecy, because the whole point of the book of prophecy is giving a message, not of history, but about history, but a prophetic message, meaning what is God or what is God's prophet telling you, what insight is he giving you from history? What are we learning from history? Now, let me give you an example of author's intent when I read a book. Let's take, for example, the book of Shir HaShirim, also in Ketuvim. You've all heard of the book? According to Chazal, I'm not asking who wrote it, but what was the author's intent? Was the author's intent to write a love story? What was the author's intent? To give a message about the relationship between God and his people. What vehicle is the author using to give over that message? A love story. The author's goal, the author's intent, is to write a book about to arrive at a deeper understanding about the relationship between God and his people. And in order to clarify or to give insight on that relationship, he uses a love story as a basis for explaining that relationship. Now, why is that important when you read the book? Because if I want to understand what's the message of the book, I have to understand that. And that's what a lot of Parshanim and Chazal do. that they don't take it literally, they take the story allegorically, which is the logical thing to do. That's why that question, who's the author and who's the audience, or basically what's author's intent, is very important. Now, I want to discuss another book about author's intent, which at first glance has nothing to do with Megillat Esther, but what I want to show you today, and that will be the main topic of our shiur, it has everything to do with Megillat Esther. It's a book no one ever studies, but it's also in Ksuvim. It's called Divrei HaYomim. You've heard of it? What's Divrei HaYomim called in English? Chronicles. Okay. Now, if there's a book called Chronicles, what would I expect it to be about? About a chronicle. No. That's sort of what Divrei HaYomim means. But again, who wrote Divrei HaYomim? Want to take a wild guess? Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the time period of Ezra. There's a lot of writing being done. In fact, according to Chazal, that's the end of Torah Shebichtav, that's the end of Nevuah, and the beginning of Chochmah. That's the transition stage. So, if you remember a little bit from Divrei HaYomim, what time period is Divrei HaYomim discussing? It starts from the very beginning, but it has some genealogies. But what's the main focus of it overlaps from, it begins with King David, with the end of King David, or the middle of King David's reign, when King David, when he's king over all of Israel, doing all the kings of Yehuda, and ends with the destruction of the first temple. But why would I write a book in the second temple period about the first temple period? If I already had Sefer Melachim, Sefer Melachim is written by Yirmiyahu at the end of the first temple period. If I have Sefer Melachim, why do I need Divrei HaYomim? Why do I need the book of Chronicles if most of it is going to repeat events which I know already from another book? What? Okay. Yeah. If you're writing a book in the second temple period about the first temple period, so, what? It could be a warning, but there's something really basic going on. I'll get to the I'll try to make my point and try to clarify. No, this will take us right to Megillat Esther. In the beginning of the second temple period, which we're going to talk about at length tonight, there's one massive issue. And that is this Reshit Tzmichat Golotenu in modern day Lashon, or is this redemption? Now remember, we've survived already over 2,000 years after the destruction of the Second Temple, and we've done fine. But if you're looking at the time period after the destruction of the First Temple, it's the first time in Jewish history that we left our center. If I look at it from an historical perspective, and I'm looking at the time period right after the first temple was destroyed. As far as Jewish history is concerned, from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, from the time of entering the land and the time of Yeshua, Am Yisrael has been in the land of Israel and nowhere else. Now, there's been good years and bad years, good times and bad times, but that's the setting. When Am Yisrael goes into exile, there's very good reason to think that this whole relationship between God and His people is over. You understand why? If the temple is so central, and living in the land of Israel is so central to being Jewish, just read the Bible. You can't miss it. And especially if you know the background in Yirmiyahu, that all the so-called false prophets, or God's prophets who are saying things falsely, are telling the people, the temple can't be destroyed, it's impossible. And God will never totally forsake His people. And they're predicting that it can't happen. And the temple is destroyed, despite what all the rabbis were saying. Then there's a very good reason for all the people to think that there won't be another temple. And the Jewish people, it's over. So, what is the job of prophecy in that time period? Like you were saying, to encourage the people, it can happen. There can be redemption. And we will come back. And we have to rebuild the temple. No. The Nevi'im who described the destruction of the temple, Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, did they talk about return? From what you remember? Of course they don't only predict destruction. The main thing they talk about it's not to say destruction is going to happen. It's almost a lost cause already. One of the main points is there'll be a return. I'll give you an example that you know from Yechezkel. Remember dry bones? You all know dry bones, don't you? Actually, I just need a copy for the thing. Everyone knows dry bones? What's that about? What are the dry bones saying? Right? That what? That we're dry bones, and dry bones can't come back to life. Yafshua smatenu, nigzanu lanu. And the analogy is that the people are saying we're like a dead body. We're like a skeleton. They can't come back to life. And they understand exile is an irreversible process. And what does Yechezkel say? It looks like you're dead, but you're going to come back to life. Not everyone accepted that. Most people didn't. Yirmiyah also said, one day you'll come back, but you have to want to come back. We'll see the source very soon. Now, when the Babylonian Empire falls and the Persian Empire takes over, we'll read the sources very soon. There's a new Persian king. His name was Koresh or Cyrus. There's an opportunity to return to the land. I'm sure you're familiar with the famous Cyrus Declaration. Okay. When it's given, some Jews return. But most of them stay, don't they? The question's going to be, what was supposed to happen? Or what was God expecting to happen? If you were a prophet, or if you were God, and you sent your people into exile, but they're still your people, and you want them to come back, and you got rid of the Babylonians, you brought in the Persians, and the great Persian conqueror allows the Jews to return and build the temple, what would you expect your people to do? Come back. No. And what happened instead? Some came back, but most didn't. No. The question is, does Megillat Esther relate to that situation? Where the Jews are scattered in the entire Persian Empire, they could have come back, and they don't come back. If I take that historical background when I read Megillat Esther, the question is, does the story of Megillat Esther relate to that prophetic and historical setting? Is that clear? When I'm reading the Megillah, do I have to take into consideration what's happening in Jewish history during that time period? I think you have to. There's no way you can't. And I have to take into consideration what's the underlying or overriding theme of the Bible about a nation representing God, and a nation chosen by God to represent Him, and the land of Israel being given as the center of that nation, and the temple being a symbol of God's presence in that nation. Add to that the predictions and the prophecies of return and rebuilding and fixing and rehabilitating the nation. The historical saying that the Jews had an opportunity to return. What would you feel like if you gave your nation an opportunity to return and they don't answer? Or if I want to put it in a different type of setting, you know what it would be like? Let's say there was a king who wanted to show off how great he was. And he had a trophy wife. And that was a way of showing how great he was. And he invites her to come back or come and show off her beauty. And the queen doesn't want to come. Would he be angry? Would he be upset? Okay. Sound familiar? No, that's the question. When you read the opening story of Megillat Esther, is there a subtext behind the story? No? Or is there something hidden, pun intended, in the Megillah? Why is that a pun? Yeah, because what's Esther's name? It's hidden. No, we can go on and on, but that's the main question. Not only who's the author, not a technicality, but the need to take into consideration the time period. Who's the audience? What's the setting? And more than that, the biggest question, how come, even though this book is in the dream, how come God's name isn't mentioned? Now, is that because God's not involved? Or is it he's so involved, it's by not mentioning his name, it's to mention his name. We call it satire. And so again, when I'm reading Megillat Esther, am I reading it as a historical book, oh, here's what happened, and I have to thank God for saving us? Or is it a book that's coming with a prophetic comment about why these events happened and what we can learn from them? And that's why there's a big argument among all different commentators. Was the book written for this audience of why the Jews didn't return? Or is this a book about Jews in diaspora and has absolutely no connection at all to the land of Israel? And that's what we're going to discuss tonight again. Who's the author, the time period, and the audience. Now, I was mentioning before, now we'll start this here in a minute, pretty much whoever arrived. Yeah, we're good. I mentioned the Book of Chronicles. The Book of Chronicles reviews the time period of the First Temple, primarily focusing on King David and then the kings of Yehuda. But if you compare that to the Book of Shmuel and the Book of Malachim, the focus is totally different. If you look at the Book of Divrei Hayamim, there's one topic. And the topic is rebuilding Yerushalayim, or building Yerushalayim and the temple. And all the efforts made by King David and following kings to build up Yerushalayim. If I take every story in Divrei Hayamim, what's there? Each story begins and focuses on building Yerushalayim and the temple. You can check it out when you're bored one day. Go story by story. I don't begin with David and Goliath. I don't begin with David and Shaul. I begin with David becoming king, and the first thing he does, he captures Yerushalayim. He moves his center to Yerushalayim. He brings the Aron to Yerushalayim. He wants to build a temple in Yerushalayim. And he gets everything ready to build the temple, so Shlomo can get started. And if there's any detailed stories in Divrei Hayamim Bet, it's about the Mikdash. A prayer for the Mikdash, renovating the Mikdash, or doing something wrong in the Mikdash. And the book ends with the destruction of the temple and the beginning of the rebuilding of the next. And the book goes right into the Book of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now we're going to start our main part. That was our introduction. And now look at the source sheet. We'll just follow it now. So our first topic was considering author's intent when studying a book in the Bible. Okay, and we got examples from Shir HaShirim and from Divrei Hayamim. Okay, now. Our main historical source of the Second Temple period, aside from Megillat Esther, is going to be in one book, the book what's called Ezra Nehemiah. Again, I'll leave you a little bit for homework. The last two lines of Divrei Hayamim are the first two lines of Ezra Nehemiah, which in my opinion means one very basic point. It's the same book. What's the difference between them? It's the same authors. They're all on Shekhinah Sarah Gdola. If Divrei Hayamim is all the efforts that were done in the first temple period to build up Yerushalayim and the Mikdash, the book is being written in the second temple period to inspire the people of the second temple period to do something. I'll give you an example from today. If I want to inspire young people to go join the Israeli army, or to go sit and learn Torah, or to do or become scientists, right? What do I do? What type of stories do I write for them? Right? I take great success stories. I take stories about great men of war, or great scientists, whatever it might be, or great Torah scholars, and talk about how they grew up. They began as little kids, and they grow, and they. I write stories to inspire people, and some are even true. But there's nothing wrong with presenting a story written to inspire a generation. But doesn't every society have that? Every culture does that, and there's nothing wrong with that. And if I read Divrei Hayamim, not as a book of chronicles, let me know what happened, but a book of inspiration, then don't be surprised that the book of Ezra and Nehemiah is going to focus on what topic? Of all the efforts made by the Jewish people in the beginning of the Second Temple period to rebuild the temple. And therefore it begins with the Cyrus Declaration and continues with the building freeze and then rebuilding the temple. And every stage and every effort made by the Jewish people to rebuild what's called Beit Sheni. Aside from that, it doesn't discuss anything else other than topics relating to Yerushalayim and the Mikdash. Now, and therefore we're going to need the book of Ezra and Nehemiah to figure out what's the historical background of Megillat Esther. What other information do we have in Megillat Esther that can tell us about the time period? We know the name of the king. His name was Ahasuerus, and the Persian time period that he was reigned from Hodu Ad Kush, that's the widest expanse of the Persian Empire. We know that. Anything else historical we know? Yeah? Does it say that? Who is Vuglat from Yerushalayim? What you said was interpretation. What's the pasuk say? Ish Yudi, we know by heart. Hayav Shushan Habira, Ushmo, Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Ishmini, Asher Oglav Yerushalayim. Did you ever diagram sentences in school way back? Remember diagramming sentences? Yeah. Who is Asher Oglav Yerushalayim referring to? Would that be logical? Why else would I go back four generations? What? How many people were introduced going back four generations. If I'm going to go back 10 generations, go back three, go back, why four? But if I'm going back four generations, maybe the last one on the list was Asher Huglam Yerushalayim. Understand? And that would help us identify where's Mordechai in relation to Jewish history. Is Mordechai one of the exiles from Yerushalayim, or is Mordechai the great-grandson of that exile? That's a difference of 100 years, isn't it? That's something we have to take in consideration. Okay. Not to mention his name. We have plenty of names of Jewish people of the first temple period, don't we? Is anyone ever called Mordechai? What's the shorish of the name Mordechai? That's not a Jewish shorish, is it? Jewish shorish have three letters. Okay. Mordechai, we have a name like that. We have Mordach Baladan. Who's what? Who's a Babylonian king. We have Ebim Merodach, another Babylonian king. Why all the Babylonian kings have Merodach in their name? Because Marduk is the chief Babylonian god. Why would a Jew name a child after a Babylonian god? Would a Jew name his son Christopher or Matthew or... Yeah. It might happen, but at what stage will that happen? First generation or fourth generation? Well, that's typical for fourth generation, isn't it? So there's something else going on. No. So these are things we have to take into consideration. The last thing we need to do is look at outside sources. If you go to a library, or do Wikipedia, it's a little bit easier, and look up the list of Persian kings, is there a chance that I should find someone named Ahasuerus? Why not? Yeah, so if you've ever been by the King David Hotel in Israel, there's a little side street there called Rehov Lincoln. Anyone ever see it? Rehov Lincoln? Yeah. Who's it named after? President Lincoln. No, how come it's called Lincoln? Because when you take there's a family, before they made Aliyah, they were the Schwartzes. They made Aliyah, their name was switched to Schwartz. Understand what happens? That happens all the time. When you take letters in one language and switch it to a different language, so it takes on the rules of that language. If you know your Aramaic, adding an aleph to a word, that's how we do that to all the words. And therefore, the name may be Chashrash. Or most likely, we'll see, it would fit into the name Xerxes. Now, do we find a Persian king named Koresh? We find someone named Cyrus. Now, remember, when we read this about this in English, his name wasn't Cyrus. His name wasn't Koresh. It was something in between. It was something in Persian. And his name wasn't Xerxes. It wasn't Ahasuerus. It was Xerxes or something like that. I can't pronounce my Persian there too well. But find a Persian. They can tell you. The other thing I can do to identify the time period is to go to a library or go to an historical work. And, of course, you have to check the sources, what they based it on, and see, is there a Persian king that fits into this time period? And therefore, what we need to do is, what's the historical setting of the book? So, if you look on part two, called Taking This Concept on Stemming Gelt Esther, I need to look at the book of Ezra Nehemiah. Okay? And again, it's a book about rebuilding Yerushalayim the temple. I need to look at the Persian kings in the book of Ezra and see if that fits into Megillat Esther. And I feel like looking at historical sources as well as the Chumash and the Bible, as well as Tanakh. And then the final thing we need to do, which we already began our discussion of, was what's the prophetic setting? So when you study a book of Tanakh, why do you have to take into consideration the prophetic setting? Like asking, it's obvious. If the book is canonized, it has to have a prophetic message. So we'll begin with our sources. A lot of them we're going to skip. These are a lot of the sources here, just so you have a background, so you can look it up later on. We're going to return to these sources later on. I want you to look at page 2. The second page, which is Roman numeral 6. Okay. If you go to the library, these are lists of the Persian kings that you're going to find in the years. Remember, everyone's heard of 586 is when the first temple was destroyed. I'm going the classic years you find in regular history books. You won't find these in art scroll. That's a different year. You know, the Seder Olam has a different history. can be explained, but that's complicated. Okay. Cyrus fits very nicely with Koresh. Okay. The next king is called Cambyses. Okay, who he is, we're not sure. There's a king named Darius. There's a lot of Dariuses. This would be Darius the First. There's a king named Xerxes and Artaxerxes. Who talks about them in detail? There's a Greek historian. His name is, in Hebrew, Herodotus or Herodotus, something like that. He's famous. He's like the first great historian of ancient history. And even though he's Greek, for some reason the Greeks and the Persians like to fight like the dabbing in the same shul. They fought all the time. They were fighting all the time. Great wars. You've heard of the Battle of Marathon? Yeah. That was Darius, you know, trying to take over Greece. Xerxes tries something very similar. And they almost win and end up losing in the end. They're fighting for hundreds of years, the Greeks and the Persians. And therefore, a Greek historian writes about the Persian kings and about how they fought Greece. Now, then we have a king named Artaxerxes. And if I want to match these up with kings in the Bible, or in the book of Ezra, Cyrus would match Koresh, Daryavish would match Darius, Achashverosh would match Xerxes, and Artaxerxes would match Artaxerxes. And that's what almost all academic circles talk about. They match up, in fact, outside history and biblical history match up very nicely. Again, Seder Olam, the classic Midrashic source, has a totally different take on things, a topic for a different class. That's source 7, which we're skipping. Now, what I want to do is try to understand what's happening in Jewish history if Achashverosh of the Megillah is this Achashverosh between Darius and Artaxerxes. You understand? If Achashverosh of the Megillah is 486, what does that mean? The second temple is already built. What we need to do is, what's happening in Jewish history? What does the book of Ezra say about this time period? What? Louder? Which exile? So what we need to do to make sure it's clear, we have to go over the basic dates of Jewish history. I want to make sure it's crystal clear. You've all heard of the first temple period? No. It begins with what king? Shlomo. That's simple. Okay. Another 15 kings or so. I think 18, 19 kings. Okay. Who's the last king? Under what? Whose king is the temple destroyed under? Tzidkiel. He's the last king. That's 586. But there was a wave of exile beforehand. 11 years before the temple was destroyed, there was what's called Galut Yehoyachin. Or Galut Yechonia. Understand? It's the same name, just pronounced two different ways. What happened? When the Babylonians first took over, King Jehoiakim put up a white flag. But like usual, a couple years after the Babylonians took over, the Jews decided we're going to rebel because God's on our side. And they rebelled against Babel. Who says it's a bad idea? That's Yirmiyahu. That's famous. But they rebel anyhow. They don't listen to the rabbis. And in fact, they listen to the wrong rabbis. There's only one rabbi who said don't rebel, and everyone else said do rebel. Nebuchadnezzar comes in, takes over the city, exiles all the people who were behind the revolt. Who's that? The political leaders, the industrialists, the big shots. Who did he leave behind? The normal people, the regular, simple people, the good citizens. And he puts Joachim's uncle in charge, or Joachim's uncle, Yoshio's other son, Tzidkiel. Changes his name to Tzidkiel, and he's in charge. On what condition? That Babylonian sovereign, and you're a vassal king to the Babylonian Empire. And the Jews could have stayed in Yerushalayim, and the temple could have remained as long as they kept under Babylonian power. What happens about 3-4 years later? What did Tzidkiel decide to do? He and his right-wing friends. Want to take a wild guess? No. They rebel. Who says don't rebel? Yirmiyahu. But they go anyhow. Who says do rebel? Not just the king, but all the other rabbis. That Yirmiyahu calls the false prophets. Okay, they're saying false things in God's name. No. 11 years into his reign, the Babylonians destroy the temple and kick out almost everybody else. Now, Gedaliah is left over, and that doesn't last very long either. Understand? Yirmiyahu warned against this. But he said that the Babylonians will be in charge for the next 70 years. If you accept them, you stay. If you don't accept them, you're gone. And what happened, sure enough, 7 years after the Babylonians took over, which is 52 years after the temple was destroyed, the Persians defeat the Babylonians. The new Persian king named is Koresh or Cyrus. And he allows the Jews to return to their land. Now, according to everybody, Cyrus is the first Persian king. And therefore, according to everybody, the story in Megillat Esther, which is Persian time period, is after the Cyrus decree. In other words, when the Megillah is written, the Jews already have an opportunity to return. According to every opinion. Yeah. Now the question is, how much later was that? So I want to show you if Cyrus is Koresh, the Persian kings, and Ahasuerus is Xerxes, then it's not soon after Cyrus, it's way after Cyrus. And we have to figure out what was happening under Dayabash and Darius. Now, what's the problem? You all learned growing up that Darius was the son of Esther. Who learned that? Didn't most of you learn that? It doesn't say that anywhere in Tanakh sources. Where does it say it? That's a Midrash. It's a beautiful Midrash. But definitely isn't Pshat at all. If I want to identify, according to Pshat, where's Ahasuerus in the Megillah, it would fit much more to Xerxes. So we have to see what's happening in Jewish history under the previous king, Dayavesh, to appreciate what's happening under Xerxes. So what are our sources? Go to source, the next page. There's one page called Historical Background of Megillat Esther. What we need to do now, I want to paint the prophetic picture of Megillat Esther. What's the setting? What's happening in Jewish history? The book of Ezra, which is the same authorship as Megillat Esther, in fact, I think they work in sync with each other, describes what God expected to happen when Koresh came into power. Anyone want to volunteer to read? Give me a little bit. Anyone like reading? Oh, yeah, read. Torah Mitzvah call out, right? Okay, read. Read, and I'll translate, but read the Hebrew side. From Ezra chapter 1, Pasuk Aleph. And then what happened? The first year of the reign of Koresh, prophecy decides that what? That the hand of God is behind this. In other words, who inspired Koresh to do this? Our God. And continue. Pasuk Bet, Kolmar Koresh. One more line. Yibachem. Now, this is called the Cyrus Declaration, where the Jews are given permission to go back to Yerushalayim, not become a sovereign state, but to build their temple. I wouldn't call it redemption deluxe, but it's a nice start. And there's, if you heard of the Cyrus Cylinder, it supports this. It's in the British Museum. There's a document written in stone, in fact, more than one copy has been found, where when Cyrus takes over and makes his declaration, it's not only the Jews can return, but all the ethnic groups that the Babylonians had exiled can return to their lands. As part of its political approach, don't be mean to everybody. Everyone was angry with the Babylonians because they exiled everyone. Go back to your land, do whatever you want, ethnically, religiously, build temples to your gods. Just pay your taxes and serve in the army. We had that problem in Israel today. That's what we need to do. And therefore, to do that, that was his approach. And what does prophecy say? What did the rabbi say? This is the hand of God behind these events. Here, Hashem Yitbarach Koresh. God inspired him to do this. He thought he was doing it for political reasons. God's saying, God was inspiring him to do this as a message to his people. Now, there's a detail here which is key to understand Chazal's approach to the Megillah. Listen to the next two lines. Pasuk Dalet. This is for Toronto. Okay. The Chonish. Okay, what happens? He says he knows the Jewish people. Whoever wants to make Aliyah can go. What should everyone else do? Send money. Isn't that amazing? It was written almost 3,000 years ago and nothing's changed. Now, skip the Pasuk Zayin. This is the detail which is critical. Pasuk Zayin. Ba-melech? Continue. That's a gizbar. What does Koresh do as a sign of goodwill to the Jewish people? He goes into the palace of Nebuchadnezzar that he had taken over. And Nebuchadnezzar had taken the vessels of the temple when it was destroyed and kept it in his archive, in his palace. What did Koresh do? Because he took over Babylonia. He went into Nebuchadnezzar's palace, took out the vessels of God's temple, and gave them to the Jews to bring back to Yerushalayim. Why should that bother everybody? What did they teach you growing up? What? No, that could be. Teach when they have extras, maybe they had newer stuff. But what did you learn in school? Yeah. Yeah. Who learned about a party? Isn't there a party at the beginning of the Megillah? And to keep the Misnagdim happy, we have a minhag. Know the minhag we do when we read the Megillah? Yeah. Because even Misnagdim have to be a little happy. And there's nothing that makes the Misnagdim more happy than the 3 weeks or the 9 days. Like Tisha B'Av. And therefore, on Purim, we have to get a little geshmak at Tisha B'Av in there. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? No. We read the Kelim, Kelim Shunim like Eicha. What's the real reason for the minhag? Because there's a famous midrash asking a very basic question, which is, why are the Jewish people almost destroyed? That's the question the Gemara asks, Megillah Daf Yud Daled. Why is it that the Jewish people were almost destroyed? They were this close to destruction. God saves them at the last minute. They must have done something wrong. So what did they do wrong? What? At the great party, how many days was that party? It's a long party. Even high school kids can't do that. Not to mention college kids. It's usually one semester or two semesters. A 180-day party. Right? And what are they doing in the party? He said, Jews participated in the party. And what did they do wrong? Some of the vessels at the party that they drank from really belong to God's temple. It's called Mi'ilah. You would call that a misdemeanor. In Jewish law, using a vessel from the temple for personal use, it's not idol worship, but is it? It's just not nice. It's not right. It's not respectful. It's like going in shul and climbing on the rabbi's chair to change a light bulb. Or climbing up the Aron Kodesh to hang up your coat on the Aron Kodesh. It's disrespectful. But again, it's a misdemeanor. Now, the problem with that midrash is that according to Tanakh, which is a pretty good source, right, the kidim of the Beit HaMikdash were returned already. Got that? And Achashverosh was plenty wealthy. He had plenty of things. He had plenty of other things to use. Now, it could be that we're talking about a felony, not a misdemeanor. What would the felony be? Or basically, what's the Medrash doing? It's connecting the party to the Beit HaMikdash. Now, at a thematic level, or at a hidden level, right, why would the Megillah write the Kelim Kelim Shonim in this like strange way? Because he wants the reader to associate the story in the Megillah to the Beit HaMikdash. But where are the Kelim during the Persian time period, from the first year of Koresh? They're back in Yerushalayim. But who's not in Yerushalayim? The Jews aren't there. And maybe that's what the Medrash is talking about, or alluding to. Is there a hidden voice, is there a subtext in the Megillah that's telling you something is wrong here? Because if you were God, and you did everything, historically, to bring the Jewish people back, and they don't answer the call, again, there's a reason why you wouldn't be so happy. And there might be a reason why keep this nation if they're not doing what I chose them for. And that might be one example of again what Kedim Kedim Shurnim are. Now, if I know this pasuk, and then I read the Megillah, and then I read the rabbinic interpretation, right, that's very different than just reading the rabbinic interpretation without these psukim. Because if I don't have these psukim, I might take that midrash literally. With these psukim, what's that forced me to do? To take the midrash thematically. Not to take it as a historical event. Again, not to take the Kelim Kelim Shonim as Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash, but it's saying the reader must take into consideration the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash that aren't there anymore. They're in Yerushalayim. I'll give you another example. Why did Achashverosh make the party? According to Pshat, how come he made the party? He likes to make parties. He needs an excuse. If you know the real history, in the third year of Xerxes, that's when they go to war against the Greeks again. And in Shushan, there's not a 180-day party, it's they're staging the biggest army ever put together up in the with the cross of the Bosphorus, and Ahasuerus wants, Xerxes wants to do what Darius didn't finish. In the battle marathon, he wants to do it better and get it right. It looks like a party, maybe. There is a real historical event in that year, but it's not, it's more than a party. But the Megillah talks about it from its angle. And therefore, the question is, when you study that story, why does the Megillah write the story the way it does? Is it alluding to something deeper, or just, that's what happened? No. Look in the next source, in Yirmiyahu Perek Chavtet. I want to show you, what did God expect to happen? Again, from Yirmiyahu's point of view. What was supposed to happen when Babylonian 7 years are over? So read chapter 29. What's Yirmiyahu talking about? The people in Yirmiyahu's time are hoping, after the first wave of exile, that within 2 or 3 years' time, the Jews are coming back. Yirmiyahu says, you have a 7 year wait. Take your time. And he writes a letter and says, you stay in Babel, because you're the future of the Jewish people. And they're itching to return already. Yirmiyahu tells the people in Yerushalayim, you're in Babel for the next 70 years, or the people went into exile. But what will happen after the 7 years of Babylonian reign? When the Babylonians fall, God will give you an opportunity to return. But what do you need to do? You're not going to come automatically. What do you need to do? You have to want to come. Read, continue your gimel. You understand what he's saying? I'm not going to bring you back automatically. I'll give you the opportunity to return, but you have to want to return. You want to come, I'll be there for you. And therefore, it's clear from Yirmiyahu what's supposed to happen after the Cyrus Declaration. What would God expect from his people to do? He expected them to come back. And how would he feel if they didn't come back? No. Historically, the Jews return the first, second year of Koresh. They return. In the book of Ezra, they talk about that return. It listed the names even. And the next year, we have what's called the First Intifada, or the First Building Freeze. The local population, which isn't Jewish, and there's lots of non-Jews, there's more non-Jews than Jews in the city, are not happy with this new group of Jews coming to Palestine and starting to build temples, and they don't want them here. To them, they're foreigners. And they start complaining. First, they say, we want this to be an international city. We want to build a temple with you. Because he's our God, you know, your God is our God. And they want to join together. Zerubbabel, their leader, says, no, we can't do that. This is a Jewish project. They get into a big fight. They start scaring them. They said they have lobbyists with the Persian authorities. And they're able to get a building freeze the next year. And therefore, they never break ground in the time of Koresh. And there's a building freeze for 18 years. 18 years later, there's a new Persian king named Darius. A new administration in Persia. And now that's a new opportunity to build. We call it, you know, the Republicans are back in, if you know American politics. I hope you know the American. You understand the analogy. Now, the prophets of that time are Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai, you've heard of them, Haggai and Zechariah? All of Haggai and Zechariah's prophecies are year two and four of Dariush. Because what's happening in those years? That's when they break ground on the second temple. Now, look at the first line of Haggai, and you'll see the setting. Yeah, those are the leaders of Babel. Remember, Kate Babel's Babel? He's the political leader of royal descent. And Yeshua ben Yosadak is the Kohen Gadol. Continue. Go. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped the line. I'll read it for you. He says, Ha'am ezamru lo'id ba beit Hashem libanot. Haggai says, the people are saying, this isn't time to build. Why are the people saying that? Imagine the few who did make Aliyah, with great helps to build the temple. As soon as they get there, they start building and there's a freeze. They feel like they're down and depressed, aren't they? They should be. What conclusion are they reaching? God doesn't want us back. We should have stayed behind. We made the mistake of making Aliyah. And they're interpreting the historical events as God doesn't want us. Haggai is saying, The people are saying, it's not time to build. God's saying, it is time to build. Get your act together, start cutting down trees, get the building, get an architect, get the funding. And then he promises them, now pasuk tet, gedol. What is Haggai promising or hoping for? That the second temple will get off the ground. And in the second year of Dayavesh, they begin construction. It happens on Hanukkah of that year, 24th to 25th of Kislev. And then it takes 4 years, and over the next 4 years, they finish building the Beit HaMikdash. In the sixth year of Dayavesh, they finish. And in year, in year four, in the middle of the building, they send a big question: do we have to fast on Tisha B'Av anymore? Now, Haggai's colleague is Zechariah. Let's read what Zechariah says. Remember, Radi V'Sim Chibat Zion? We read that story on Hanukkah. It's, be happy, which means the people are sad. Ki nibam v'shechanti b'tochech. All in the second year of Dayavesh, as they break ground on the temple. Don't worry, be happy, because God's Shekhinah is going to return, and things will be better. Now we'll just read one pasuk at Zion. It's from benching. Nachem. Just one example, we can read many. Zechariah is saying the temple can be rebuilt. Right? It might need to be a Torah Chaim, and the bracha of in benching is built on this, and in Shmoneh Esrei. Remember, Yushem Becha Brachamim Tashuv, V'tishkom Tocha, Kasher Dibarta. Where did God say he's going to return and rebuild Yerushalayim Brachamim? Here in Zechariah. Now, 2 years later, it's halfway done, the temple. There's a delegation from Bavel with a big question. Now that the temple is being rebuilt, do we have to fast? On Tisha B'Av anymore, there was a custom for 7 years to fast, since it was destroyed. They asked the question, and Zechariah gives a really great answer. He says, you know, you're coming and asking if you have to fast. You know what he answers? God didn't ask. He's asking me whether you decided to fast. That's not a Zoraita. That's not a biblical obligation. If you're asking God questions, ask him about biblical obligations, not rabbinic customs. He says, if you want to fast, it's up to you. But if you want asking already, what does God want you to do? He gives him a nice shopping list. Now, listen to the shopping list and tell me if it sounds like anything in the Megillah. Okay, have it to Zion. Either. As they're building the temple, what is it that God wants his people to do? We'll see in a minute all the things that they did wrong in the first temple period that caused it to be destroyed. Listen to what he focuses on. Pasuk Kazan. Meaning what? Ishet Re'eu. Speak truthfully, it's talking about working together properly as a society. Okay? Bish? Okay? That's what you need to do. And then, what will finally be with the fast days? The famous line I'm sure you've heard before. Pasuk Yevchet Nyutet. What's he saying? What's going to happen? The fast days, not only won't be fast days anymore, they'll turn into holidays. On what condition? What do we need to do for that to happen? We have to do Emet V'Shalom. Now, are the words Emet V'Shalom or Shalom V'Emet in Megillat Esther? At the very end. And they don't make any sense over there. Is there Ishit or Eyu anywhere in the Megillah? Do you ever wonder why Mishloach Monot is the way we remember Purim? According to the Megillah, how do you celebrate Purim? According to the Megillah, what was the original celebration of Purim? Instead of a? Yeah. It was, we went Be'evel L'Simcha. Didn't we? It was, the mitzvah is to have a Yom Mishteh on the day that was the Yom Eva. And what do we do on this Yom Mishteh? We Mishloach Monot Yisrael U'Matzat Avionim. Let me give you an example. Why do we eat matzah on Pesach? Is there any connection between eating matzah and coming out of Egypt? Of course there is, right? When there's a special mitzvah on the holiday, how can we sit in a sukkah on sukkahs? Because that's what the holiday is about. Now, I understand reading Megillah. Because you tell the story, but it doesn't say in the Megillah you have to read the Megillah. It wasn't written yet, the Megillah, when the events happened. But how do you remember the events of the Megillah? By making a party, a celebration on a fast day? or a day that would have, that should have been a fast day, and making a mishteh. Remember, banafochu, remember, miyogon nisimcha me'evel liyom tov. And what mitzvot do we do on the day? Meshach mor Israel, maton of yonim. What's that to do with Purim? So it could be that's the din of every Yom Tov. But why is that the only mitzvah Purim? Do something that relates to the events. No, maybe build 50 Amma towers or something, or build galvos, or make hats like Haman wore. Something like that. But what? Why is that the reason? But the wording is so similar to Zechariah, something's going on. Now, why am I making a big deal about Zechariah? We'll see why. Let's go back historically. All the Nevuot of Haggai and Zechariah are under what king? The second and fourth year of Dariavish is the building of the temple. Who's the next Persian king? Achashverosh. Understand? Now, if during the reign of Darius, Dariavish, not only did the Jews return, but the temple was finally built, and God enables them to build it, and King Darius changes his policy, and the Jews finish the temple, what should the rest of the exile do by now? They should have gone back already. Okay. What do we find as Megillat Esther opens up? If Megillat Esther is during Xerxes, remember, of the Persian kings, who's after Darius, which means it's 20, 30 years after the temple was built already, where are the Jewish people? You know the Pasuk Bahar. Yishno Amachad, Mufuzarim Frad Ben Amin. There's a nation that, where are they? They're scattered. Where are they scattered? All over the place. Over 120, how many Medina last count? Strange number, isn't it? And there's no Persian source for that. But 127, I think, is one time in Tanakh. Okay, but what's the context? Yeah. Okay. And what's the next pasuk? What's Avram do? It's the first time Avram buys real estate in the land of Israel, isn't it? And then, and what's it? Gever toshav anochi machem? Tudeh chuzat kever machem? You know how many times that concept goes up again, over and over again about this is the first time we bought something? Even though I'm a gever toshav, you follow? Keeping a foothold in the land? No. Or it could be there are 127 Medinot, but that's, again, that's always the question when you read. Now, but more than that, if who is the melech of the Megillah? Remember, it never says God. But isn't there always a double voice? So, yes, there's a nation, scattered among the nations, and they're not listening to the melech. And it's not worth for the king to let them live. Remember, give me a letter, let me destroy them. Now, that's Haman talking, isn't it? But is there a subtext? Is that God talking as well? And explaining why we're almost destroyed? Not why we're saved, but why we're almost destroyed? And why God's angry? Here's another example of that. Now, if Megillat Esther is happening after Dayavish, it's bad enough if it's after Koresh, but if it's after Dayavish and after the temple is built already, then there's no excuse to be 120, to be all scattered around like that. And maybe the Megillah is coming to explain why is it that we're almost destroyed? And then we have to understand why did God save us anyhow? Even though we were deserving of being destroyed. Now, after Zechariah, now we're still in Zechariah, we're still in, you know, Zechariah chapter 8, right after Pasachaf. After Zechariah answers the question about the fast days will turn into holidays, he then gives greater hopes for Bayit Sheni. And listen to what he talks about. Listen carefully, because this will be key. Pasachaf. Kol Hashem Tzvot. A time will come where what? Not only will Jews finally return to the land, but when the Jews are in their land, and the fast days will turn to holidays, and the Jewish people are doing shalom ve'emet, what will happen? Other nations will come. Continue. Well, amim rabim. Other nations will come to Jerusalem. Remember, Yeshayahu talks about that? Kimitzion Teitei Torah? It's chapter 2 in Yeshayahu, or it's in the outside the UN, or the second half is outside the UN. Kimitzion, Vachu, But no, look, all the nations will come, like rivers coming to your country. There's still big hopes for Bayit Sheni. That's what Chagai was talking about. And he's saying not only is the Jews going to return, but also non-Jews will come to visit. Okay, now finish. Chaf Gimel. Kol Ma'ashem. What's that mean? What days? When other nations will come to visit the Jews in Yerushalayim, when things are successful and we have Shalom Be'emet, what will happen? Asher Yachziku. Things will be so good, and there'll be such traffic jams in Yerushalayim, there'll be 10 non-Jews coming to Yerushalayim looking for guidance, all waiting in line and holding on to the corner of a garment. Remember little kids holding on to the parents' sides? Saying, we want to follow, we're looking for guidance. Because we heard the guy's with you. Now, this is the only time in Tanakh, other than Megillat Esther, that we have what phrase? Ish Yehudi. And according to Zechariah, where is Ish Yehudi supposed to be? And what's he supposed to be doing? Bringing non-Jews to the recognition of God. And this was supposed to be happening when? After the temple was rebuilt, and the Jews answered God's call. And what do we find a couple of decades later? We find an Ish Yehudi, who should be where? In the Bira, in Yerushalayim HaBira. And where is he instead? And what's his name? Making a name for who? What's God? Okay, I'm not saying Mordechai is not about how religious he is. I want you to have an understanding of what the satire is, if you know Navi Zechariah. No, here's what I contend. Zechariah is the last Navi of the Second Temple period. And he's a Navi who talks about the Shekhinah returning. You know that from Hanukkah. Roni b'simchi bat Zion. He has the vision of the menorah, remember? Lo b'chai v'lo b'kloch kim bruchi. There's great hopes for Bayit Sheni. Chagai, kadol yakvod ha'bayit hazeh. If the Jews don't answer that call, wouldn't God be upset? Wouldn't that be a reason to destroy his people? You know, how can you not take that into consideration when you read Megillat Esther? Because the Megillah will never spill the beans. But you can't write a satire and spill the beans. But can you give enough hopes? Can you give enough traces to put something together? Now, if you never read the book of Zechariah, and you don't know the time period, you'll never notice it. It's like reading Animal Farm and not knowing about the Russian Revolution. It's a great book. But you missed the whole point. If Zechariah is the last Navi and Megillat Esther is happening the next generation, and in the Megillah we have all these allusions to words and phrases and key phrases in the Nevuot of Zechariah, and this is Nevuah of a delegation from Babel asking, do we have to fast on Tisha B'Av now that the temple is rebuilt? It could be that all this imagery is intentional. And instead of the Yehudi being in Yerushalayim, making a name for God, and Ish Yehudi is in Shushan HaBira. Now, some people say that, do we have Shushan Purim? There's a concept of Shushan Purim, isn't there? Where do we celebrate it? In Yerushalayim. Yeah, almost Venafochu, isn't it? Not to notice this, you'd almost have to be drunk. If you wanted, there's so many connections between them, and every time you look, you find more and more. Now, look in source, who's the king? See the next one? We read this before. See, Ben-Mir Haman, Lamech, Yishu Amachad, and Tuzafrad Ben Amim, V'tateh Melech, V'shonot B'ko'am. They're different? Now, one other thing I should have mentioned. Who remembers what happened after Vashti didn't come to the party? Don't they send out an edict? Yeah, more than that. That's some cute rabbi made up and throw in. Just, what do you call it? For the fast one. Okay. Now, what did they say? V'yot ko'ish, u'medaber, and the next line is? Well, and the next line? Yidal melech et Haman. That leads into our story, doesn't it? No. Yeah, that leads to what do you call it? That's years later. That's the seventh year already, or sixth, seventh year when they get to Esther. There's a gap in between. But there's an edict that every nation has to do what? To speak their own language. What nation is that? Where every nation is supposed to be what they're supposed to be. what they're supposed to be doing. And what's that to do with the Megillah? What's happening is very strange. Not to mention the whole party. Right? Isn't there imagery of the temple and the party? The word Chelet and Argaman, which is unique to the Beit HaMikdash in Chumash? No. What I want to conclude with is to understand the laws of Purim. Okay. At the end of the Megillah, and again, most people don't pay attention to these Sukkim because there's no more Haman. And if it's a fast day, let's get this over with. Yeah. And we know we won. At the very end, something very strange happens. Mordechai wrote a letter for the first year and said, next year I want everyone to celebrate this celebration by doing what? By turning the fast day into a feast day. Remember, Evel Yom Tov, Evel Simcha, what's the word? Something, I'm losing it. Evel Yom Tov, isn't it? Yogon de Simcha? Remember Evel Nafochum? Yeah. So, what he's saying is, we have to make this, we have to celebrate it by taking this, like, sort of fast day or sad day into a happy day. Israel, he wants everyone to do it. And 2 days, a day for the people and a day for Shushan. And if the Megillah says that everyone kept it, that's always a good way of saying, if the Megillah is saying everyone kept it, and the next week they have to write another letter about it, if you want people to accept it, if things aren't happening, you say everyone's doing it. You want to get the bandwagon going. Now, watch what happens. At the very end of the Megillah, they have to write another letter, don't they? There's a second letter that goes out. Let's read it. Have it? It's source 11, X1, Roman numeral 11, and from Esther Paraket. Read it slowly. Vayichtov Mordechai. Here it is. Neogon Simcha. No. That's the first letter. Got that? I guess it doesn't catch on so well, and therefore they have to send a second letter. Listen to the second letter. Patikhtov. Okay, no, he's sending, that's not Megillat Esther, in Pshat. This is the second letter encouraging the people to do what? To keep the first letter. Now, Vayishlach Sfarim. What did he send in the letter? What are Divrei Shalom Vemet? Okay, what does it sound like? How do you usually translate it? Shalom Aleichem. And how about the first letter didn't have Divrei Shalom Vemet? Why is he sending, and that's the entire letter, isn't it? That's not the opening line of the letter. It's not to whom it may concern. The tochen, the content of the letter is Divrei Shalom Vemet. No. Why is he sending Divrei Shalom Vemet? Okay. If you know Zecharia, we know exactly what Divrei Shalom Vemet are. Where do we have the words Evet for Shalom? Go back to earlier up. Go back in where it says Zecharia chapter 8, towards the top of the page, in Pasuk Yutet. It says, Kol Marsham Tzvot, Tzom Arvi, V'tzom HaChamishi, V'tzom HaShvi, V'tzom HaShvi, Yilad HaBitu, L'Sashem, Tzom HaModim Tovim, V'met V'Sham HaHavo. It says, the fast days, remember? Remember, the question they sent from Golot was, do we fast on Tisha B'Av? And the Navi answers, the fast days, the four fast days, will turn into holidays. On what condition? That you're deserving of Gat Shechina by doing Dibrei Shalom B'Emet, which is a summary of the entire message of Zecharia, what he wants from you. You have to read the whole book to really appreciate what he's talking about there. And therefore, it could be Dibrei Shalom B'Emet, he's coming to explain the background from Zecharia, for those who know Zecharia. But now he explains, why am I sending Divrei Shalom Vemet? Listen carefully. The Kayim. What's that mean? Why is he writing Divrei Shalom Vemet? So the Jewish people will do what? We'll keep the first letter. What was the first letter? The first letter was to celebrate Purim with Yimei Mishteh, Mishloach Manot, and Matan Lavyonim. All concepts from Zecharia. One by one, Ishet Re'ehu, Matan Lavyonim was earlier. about being kind and setting up a just and good society and taking care of the needy. And so that's why the first temple was destroyed, because they weren't doing that. Now, we have all this imagery from Zechariah. And then he says, the first minhag didn't catch on. He has to send Divrei Shalom Vemet in order that people keep the first, the minhagim of the first letter. In other words, keep Purim like Mordechai and Esther kept it. Now continue. Kat v'chashir. What's he saying in the letter? Just like the Jewish people have taken upon themselves what? What are Divrei Hatzavot v'Zakatam? What psalm is that? Not just Tisha B'Av. All four. That's Shiva Sabbatamos, Tisha B'Av Tzum Gedalia, Asar B'Tevet, the whole four. That's what Chaya is talking about. It says, just like Am Yisrael took upon itself the four fast days to do what? To Memshaim. With the same background, for the same reason, we have to take upon ourselves to celebrate Purim. To do what? To remember Yerushalayim. I can remember Yerushalayim by fasting. I can remember Yerushalayim by feasting. V'nafochu. And we're making like an artificial Zechariah celebration of turning fast days into feast days. We're going to take Purim and turn it into what should have happened. You made Mishteh v'Simcha instead of you made Tzom. And what are we going to do to remember what we need to be worthy of having a Beit HaMikdash? Two, Levyonim, and also an Asher Ish L'Rehu. Not only for Levyonim, also for increase friendship. Because that's what brought down the first temple. If that's the background, sorry, if that's the historical background, you follow? If Zechariah is in the background, and if you want, on the first page I gave a whole list of, on part, look at back, go to part number four, or Roman number four. In Roman number four, I have all the, just a couple more parallels between Zechariah and Megillat Esther. Again, you can look them up later for homework. My claim is that if Anshei Knesset HaGdola wrote not only the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, but also Megillat Esther, they're writing it the generation afterwards. They're writing it in the time period of Artaxasta, which is when they're writing the book of Ezra, when the final section of the book of Ezra is written, when Ezra comes, the next generation. And that's when Torah Shabbat Peh, you know, we go from Nevi'im to Torah Shabbat to Torah Shabbat Peh. That's like the big transition in Jewish history. If that's the time period, there's a very harsh commentary about Jewish history. Now, if there's so many reasons why God should have destroyed Am Yisrael, well, why did He save us? Does Chumash ever talk about Am Yisrael deserving to be destroyed, but God will save us anyhow? Is there a section of Chumash that talks about that? That's in Yishayahu. I'm talking about in Chumash. No, that's getting the breach started. But where does Chumash say that you deserve to be destroyed, but I'll save you because of my name? I mean, we have a similar theme by Chet Ego, but I want it in a song. Yeah, we're in Hezino. Open up Shirat Hezino. Where's just passing up the Chumash. Yeah, look in look in Hezino. Let me get a Chumash real fast. Yeah, that's in Bechumash. Yeah. Look at Shirat Hezino. Towards the end. Look at page 1104. Page 1104 at the very bottom, Pasuk Chaf, verse 26. Amarti Afeim, if you look in English. I said, I'll scatter them, I'll get my anger at them. Ashbita, on the top, now the top of 1106. Ashbita me'anosh zikram. What am I going to do? Ashbita, now I'm going to destroy the memory from mankind. Enosh like enoshut. God's saying, you are so bad, what should have happened? I should have wiped you out. Lulei katso, eva gor, pedikir, mitzrayimah. Then he says, why can't I do it? Because they won't see the hand of God. If you go a little bit on, he says, he talks about how bad they are. Pasuk Lamed Vav, on the bottom of 1106. Ki adin Hashem amo ve'adav et necham. Who have mercy on his people. Ki rake ozlat yad ve'efes atzur ba'azuv. They'll see that the people are abandoned and no one's coming to help them. There's a safety net at the end of God will return. That's Shirat Hazinu. Now, anyone know what Shirat Hazinu is about? Is that the only topic? I must say, at the very end of Shirat Hazinu, I should have mentioned. What's the bottom line when God comes and saves us at the end? Look in page 1108. Pasuk Lamed, verse 39. It says, Ru'u, ata, ki ani, anihu, ben yadi mimadi. Ani amitfachya, machatzi, bani yapeh, ben yadi meso. What do you have to see and understand? I'm behind the events. Right? That's the final call. God will give us safety to it and save us at the end, even though we don't deserve it. But when he comes and saves us, he wants to wake up and recognize that. So, why am I relating that to Miguel that's there? Because I'll ask a question again. Esther bin Atar Minayim. Remember the other game? What's the source of everything? What pasuk did they call it? Where's there a remez to Esther Min HaTorah Minayin? Where's that from? Where in Dvarim? Not the Tochacha. It's the introduction to Shirat Hazinu. And it's in Shirat Hazinu. So take a look at the introduction to Shirat Hazinu, which is in Parsha Ve'elech. It's as simple as could be. Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Yudalad. Page 1096. God tells Moshe and Yeshua gathered together. We have a little huddle here. The old coach is leaving. The new coach is coming in. And God appears to them. Pasuk Zion, verse 16. B'yam Hashem Moshe. Hincha shochev im avotecha. What's that mean? It's time to do what? Die. And what's bound to happen? V'kama amasev ezanach rei elhe nechara tashru v'avishama b'kirbo. V'yazani v'feret briti asher karatita. What's going to happen? They're bound to sin, follow other gods, and have to punish them. Listen carefully, Pasuk Yitzayin. V'chrapi bo v'yumahu, v'zavtim. Because they leave me and follow other gods, I'm going to have to what? I have to leave them. V'starti panay mehem. I'll hide my face from them, meaning, to pray to me, I'm not going to answer. V'yelecho, umtzo rabot rabot v'tarot. Terrible things will befall them. V'yamar v'yumahu, what will the people say when all these bad things happen? Where are the people going to say, how come such bad things are happening to us? Because God's not with us. In other words, they're blaming God for their demise. Says, hey, we're your people. You're not helping us. What kind of God are you? We're your people. Why don't you come and help us? And the people will be angry with God for causing such trouble. Now, what's God's answer back? How come I was banned to you? How come I'm punishing you? Because you left me. The people are angry with God and saying, you left us. It's called the most popular Jewish family game. It's called the Bruegger's game. You know how the game goes? You didn't invite me, I'm not inviting you, you didn't come. If I don't, both sides saying it's your fault. Amiso says, God, you're not being a good guy, you're not helping us. And God punishes them and says, you're not doing your job. How are we going to get out of it? The question is, who's to blame when Jewish history goes sour? Who's to blame when things go bad for the Jewish people? Again, on the national level. What's God say? What's God going to do? Pasuk Yichet. V'nochi haster haster panay behem b'yamahu. I'll call the Rasha Asaki v'nar limacharim. I'm going to hide my face from them when that happens because they turn to other gods and they'll punish them harder. Now, how are we supposed to know? How are we going to get out of this vicious cycle? What's going to be our eternal answer to the question, who's to blame? When Jewish history goes sour, who are we going to blame? Yeah, and who are we supposed to blame? God? Ourselves. And we're supposed to realize that God's always right, and we're the ones to blame. Now, how does Shirat Hazinu say that? Here, read the next line in Pasuk Aleph. I'll bring them to the land that I promised them, and they'll go astray. In Chaf Aleph, when bad things happen, I need this song as a safety net, so I know who to blame when Jewish history goes bad. Now, Shirat Hazinu is a song. How does it begin? The first three psukim is introduction, but the song begins in Pasuk Daled, and it's all right. All right there. How does Pasuk Dalet begin? Hatzor, who's that? Tamim Polo. Meaning? He's always perfect. Ki chol drachav mishpat. He's always right. Like any good husband. But there's he's really right. God is always right. Now let's start talking. Again, Hatzor Tamim Ki chol drachav elemunah vein avel. Tzadik v'yashar hu. Five different ways. Saying what? How do we start the song? God is always right. Straight, there's nothing wrong. Shechet lo. Shechet means when something goes bad. Are we going to attribute it to him? Lamedvav? What's the answer? No. No. Who's to blame? Banat mumam. Dorei keshuv tato. Haladonai tikmu lozot. Are you going to blame it on God? Amna babo lo chacham? Why would God do something bad to you for no reason? He chose you to work for him. He wouldn't punish you for no reason. If Am Yisrael is a nation is being punished, God's behind the events. And Am Yisrael has to ask himself, what is it that we did wrong? And then, Zechori Motolam, Binushnot Avador, Shachar Chidi Agetcha. Look into history and look at the hand of God in history. And know to blame yourself when something goes wrong and not God. Now, when things go wrong, they can get really bad. There's a safety net at the end. That God ultimately will come and save us. But why does he save us? So what do we need to do next? Wake up and realize what happened. And realize to be thankful to God for saving us even though we weren't deserving. No. The question is this the setting of what happened in the time period of Megillat Esther? We were this close to destruction because we deserved to be destroyed and God saved us at the last minute with the hope that we would recognize what went wrong and do something about it. Yeah. And if that's the background of Esther Panim, remember Esther Min HaTorah Minayin, if it's relating to the theme of Shirat Hazinu, then we have again another source to what's happening in the Megillah and in the meaning of the name Esther. Now, what I want to do now is I want to go over the source sheet and make sure we understood everything. So again, as a key summary, what I'm trying to get at is that when you study Megillat Esther by itself, without taking into consideration anything historical, anything prophetic, as a standalone book, it's a great story, isn't it? As good as Animal Farm, even better. It's a great story. It's got its own internal structure. It's got its own theme, and it reads like a great play. When I take a look at it from a historical perspective, what is happening in Jewish history? Okay, you begin to raise your eyebrows. Something's going on here. When I take into consideration what should have been happening in Jewish history at the same time period, raise even more eyebrows. When I see all the literary allusions to the Beit HaMikdash, we didn't talk about Chatzer Panimit, Chatzer Chitzonah. We didn't talk about Esther being like Yom Kippur. Remember, Chazal pick up Purim Kippurim. We didn't pick out these letters. There's a 70-day difference between the first letter going out and the second letter going out. But again, we mentioned already the Kelim from the Beit HaMikdash, the Bidei Kuhuna. That are alluded to in what's happening at the party. If you take all those things together, the question is there a hidden voice in the Megillah which is giving a totally different message? Okay. And just like there must be a voice that's saying God's behind the events, with never actually saying it, do they? Remember? What's Mordechai tell Esther? This is your moment. And if you don't do it, what'll happen? From somewhere else. Obviously it's referring to God. But we'll never spill the beans. How do you allude to something in a good satire, never spill the beans? You almost say it without saying it. Because you can never spill the beans. And all the Midrashim of Chazal go in the same direction. They almost spill the beans, but they never come out and say it. And that's always the question. Is when you're reading Megillat Esther, do I have to take all that into consideration? And is the imagery from Tzchari just by chance? The author of Megillat Esther, which seems to be Second Temple period from the time period of Ezra and Nehemiah, that's what Chazal alluded to, does the author assume that his audience knows Tzchariah, and his audience knows the events, and knows how we were almost destroyed, and knows that we should have returned and we had a chance to return and we didn't? That's the big question all the time. And if that is the author's intent, and that is the authorship, and that is the audience who it's written for, then the main prophetic message of Megillat Esther is much deeper than oh, thank God for saving us again. There's something, there's the recognition that God gives Am Yisrael historical opportunities to return, and sometimes they don't answer it, and they're this close, and they might be deserving of destruction. There's always a safety net, but we're supposed to learn something from the safety net, and we can do preventive medicine by recognizing that before the trouble happens. Now, notice, I want to take Aliyah out of it for a minute. Right? It doesn't say, therefore, he has to return to Israel. Because returning to Israel wasn't enough. Because people did return. What's the problem, if you know later on? Even those who return, we have the same problems again. It's not just who's coming to Israel or not coming to Israel. It's the type of society you set up in the land of Israel. And the type of society that's necessary for redemption to happen. And that's the main message of Mashiach Mon Israel Matan Levyonim. There's no point in returning and starting the Brogas game again. There's no point in returning and having a corrupt society again. That's why God kicked us out the first time. And if we don't learn only the it's not just about returning, it's about what we do as a nation. And the need to be a nation representing God, not just by having a temple, but by acting in a way that we're deserving of a temple. And that could be the strange mitzvah of Purim about Mashiach Mon Israel Matan Levyonim really said those ideas. Yeah, question. Yeah. When you write a satire, we'll take example Animal Farm, Lahavdil. Now, the author, George Orwell, right, assumes that the reader knows about the bullshit, about the Russian Revolution. So he never state that in the book, does he? But he assumes that you put two and two together. It's a style of writing which is more, it's like being sarcastic, isn't it? People do that in regular talk, don't you? You say something without saying it. It's much more powerful by not saying it. But alluding to it, like, you know, of course that's what you're referring to. Yeah.
But maybe it's the idea, it's supposed to be the idea of the Mashal, an allegory, that the text reads one way on the page, but if you're in the know, you identify everyone on the page with everyone else in the real situation in real life.
Yeah.
You work out the Mashal for yourself.
And that's what you're supposed to do. And now, but when you discover it on your own, it makes it much more powerful. Now, you can argue, is this the best way to do something? Because I'll say it like this. It says, 48 Nevi'im tried to get Am Yisrael to do tshuva, and they all failed. Haman took off his ring. It says, the Gemara says that Haman's ring was more powerful than 48 Nevi'im. Is that something? Wait, 48 Nevi'im didn't write satire. It isn't sometimes a satire or a mashal, or ask Natan, with David and Bathsheba? He didn't say, you said, what's he do? He gives him a mashal. And he wakes up. That's ask an anthropologist why that works. But that's to do with, that's human nature. Yeah. Yeah. And the, where's the first time we find satire being written, like in outside history? Who are the first satirists? The Greeks? In what time period? Around exactly the time period of Ezra Nehemiah. The same time period, like 400 BC. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the Artaxerxes, Artaxerxes. If you read the book of Nehemiah, the next generation, but it's still meaningful. Now, Ezra Nehemiah, when you read that, the first six chapters of the book of Ezra is before Ezra is born. That's through Bavel and Yeshua and Haggai and Zechariah. But from chapter 7 to the end of the book, that's Artaxerxes, the wording, the phrases, exact same as Megillat Esther. Again, academically, almost everyone puts the writing of Megillat Esther, if you look in that Mikra in this introduction, it brings all the proofs, that the writing of Megillat Esther seems to be the same time as the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. And again, during the reign of Artaxerxes, which means it's a generation after Ahasuerus, when the Persian Empire begins to fall a little bit. Yeah, the highest point is Darius and Xerxes are the high point. Yeah.
Is there a particular reason why the story of the two letters was put in the way why there were one letter?
I mean, what happened was is the Mordechai came up with this minhag about celebrating. You follow? And the big question is, was this a one-time celebration for Shushan? Or is this something of eternal historical importance? Mordechai is claiming that behind the events of Megillat Esther, of what happened in the story, there's a message for all Jewish generations. And it's not just, you know, a personal celebration for that generation, but something eternal. What Chazal called Kitvuri Zedorot. And there was a big argument whether Megillat Esther should be accepted. You know, Purim didn't catch on for a long time. It's the only thing they didn't make it, that they didn't find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the only book of Tanakh that wasn't there. And Gabar talks about, is it in or is it out? It was a big, so we paskin and then it's in, but that was a big question. So the need for the second letter is to give it eternal meaning. And that's why the second letter attaches, in my opinion, Zechariah's and Mordechai's original minhag of Purim, of Yimei Mishteh v'Simcha, instead of Evel, Me'evel v'Yom Tov, and Meshach Monot, it attaches it to Divrei Shalom v'Emet of Zechariah. And therefore, the second letter is coming to explain the prophetic connection to the holiday. Again, if you know your Zechariah, you understood the second letter. If you don't know Zechariah, you're right. It makes no sense, the second letter. Why is he writing Divrei Shalom v'Emet? Why isn't the first letter enough? Or send the first letter twice. And why are we comparing it to Kashir Kimbul at Tibrat Samov Zakatam? He's saying, just like you're keeping the fast days to remember Yerushalayim, keep now the feast day to remember Yerushalayim. And it was, I guess, maybe the first letter we held those truths to be self-evident, and they weren't so self-evident. You know where that's talking from? That's American. Yeah, but you know American history a little bit. Well, you didn't read Yirmiyahu. You didn't read Yirmiyahu, and you didn't read the Gemara carefully. That's in Yoma. You've heard about the big three. The first one went down for the big three. Avodah Zarah, Gilurah, and Shvichus Damim. That's not Yirmiyahu. That's Menashe. All the psukim the Gemara quotes are from Yishayahu, in the time period of Chizkiyahu and Menashe. The first temple, the Gzardin of Churban, is for Menashe. It was a total disaster. You have Avodah Zarah, Gilurah, Shvichus Damim during the time of Menashe. God said, it's over. Yoshiel does repentance. And we get it back on its feet again. The final Korban, after Yoshiel, that Yoyakim in Sitkiel, according to Yirmiyahu, the people are davening, they're turning to God. Yoshiel wipes out idol worship almost totally. It's because of lack of social justice. It's black and white in Yirmiyahu. You can't miss it. Yirmiyahu Perek Zayin. So now the Gemara assumes you know Yirmiyahu, and assumes you know Malachim. The problem is you read the Gemara and you don't know the Nevi'im. You don't know the history. You don't realize what they're quoting, and you misunderstand their whole point. Now the point of the Gemara in Yoma is not to tell you why the first temple was destroyed. It says so in Tanakh. Why? It's to tell you how bad Sinat Achim is. The Gemara's whole point is telling you Sinat Achim is as bad as idol worship, and Retzach and murder. And Arias. Because everyone understands Arias and Retzach and Avodah Zarah is bad. But Sinat Achinam, that's part of our culture. Right? No. The Gemara, again, isn't coming to give you an historical fact. It's coming to tell you how bad Sinat Achim is. Read the Gemara there. Taftet Amid Bet. Taftet or Yeralef Amid Bet? In Yoma. It's 9 or 11? 9? Said, yeah. Tet Amid Bet. In Yoma. 9b. Towards the bottom. It's crystal clear. It's about Sinat Achinam. And what I'm trying to show you is that when rabbis make statements, they assume you know Yitzhak Kol. And when you read the Gemara, it's clear that the assumption is you know Yitzhak Kol. Despite the quote, have Suki, but you seem to know the rest of them. When you read all these rabbinic statements and not aware of where they're coming from and their understanding, you can totally misunderstand them. And that's why you have to know, whenever you study a topic or subject, you have to know the background behind it. Okay, any last question? We're going over time. I think probably more snow, yeah.
How far do you want to take this concept of this being historical work?
How historical are the real events?
Yeah.
So, again, the way I see it, something must have happened. Were the names changed to indict the guilty? You know, was his name really Mordechai? Was his name really Esther? Are those names to fit into the theme? Was the party really 180 days? Was it really a party? I'm assuming that during that time period, the Jewish people were close to being destroyed. And there was something bad happening. word for like there, or is it presented sort of using literary tools? The work is perfect as far as everything switching around. Remember how everything's bad and then everything goes to good from Badailahu when the king couldn't sleep. From a sifruti, from a literary point of view, the book's a masterpiece. Yeah, but that's a topic within itself. So when you write like that, how much do you have to be true to the real history, or how much do you have to be true to the prophetic meaning of that history? That you can argue. But if someone proves to you that some of the historical events aren't precise, that only tells you you have to understand it thematically, not historically. But again, the book wasn't written to teach you history. The book was written for an audience, assuming the audience knows the real history, and it's giving a prophetic comment on it. That's why you brought the example from Shir HaShirim beforehand. And again, when you read these books as history, you're going to miss the whole point of them. Now, that doesn't mean the events didn't happen. The events happened, but how you write them? There was Avraham Avinu, but the way Chumash writes about Avraham Avinu isn't to tell you history, to tell you what we learned from that history. And that realized almost every book. What really happened is not really, it's interesting, but it doesn't affect what you learn from the books.
You can come back on Sunday and hear continuations, although on different talks there actually are 15 talks on Sunday. And there are brochures, I think, at the front. There were. There you go. Thank you very much. And as I mentioned, just to know, because you can't go to three sessions at one time, we will have MP3s. So everybody who comes on Sunday will give you MP3s of the whole program. We'll send that afterwards. I want to thank you, of course, for a very illuminating, shiur. And we can make a Mariv minyan. I assume there are people who have yet heard of a Mariv, so we'll bear us few pieces of cake outside. We'll daven Mariv in 3 minutes.